Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, the poetry of immigration and building a new life, and the science, or lack of it, behind those personality tests. First, a new Eastern Standard series with EKU business professor Beth Polin as host, focusing on working mothers in today's world.
Today, we welcome to Eastern Standard Dr. Cynthia Harder, professor of economics in the College of Business at Eastern Kentucky University and director of the Center for Economic Education, and, I should add, a working mother. Thank you for being here, Dr. Harder.
Thank you for inviting me to talk with you today. This is an important topic of conversation that we're going to have, and I'm happy to talk in a more formal way than the two of us just chatting in the hallway back at EKU.
And we have had those conversations, haven't we?
Yes.
So start off by talking to me a little bit about how the financial situation of families has changed since the 1950s. And what is inspiring this question are these statistics. We've seen an increase in the number of mothers choosing to participate in the workforce. I'll share with you that mothers with children under the age of three in the workforce grew from 34% in 1975 to 64% in 2021. Mothers with children under the age of six grew from 39% in 1975 to 67% in 2021. And mothers with children between the ages of 6 and 17 grew from 55% in 1975 to 76% in 2021. What's causing this change?
Well, as you know, as someone who studied economics, economics is the study of decision making with various constraints. And this decision facing women and families is definitely a great example. The constraints facing women and families has changed a lot in 75 years, and some of it's been for better and some of it's been for worse. If we look at the financial situation, what you could buy for, say, $10 in 1950 would cost about $130 today. And so if we look at housing as a specific example of cost, the median home price in 1950 was about $7,300, which adjusting for inflation would be about $95,000 today. If you look at the median home price in 2023, it was $412,000. So housing has increased a lot in cost, and that has really changed the financial situation of families. The need for greater financial freedom and security has certainly been a significant driver behind mothers entering the workforce. And the statistics that you quoted, if we're looking at 2021, looking at post-pandemic, I think that when you look at post-pandemic labor force participation rates for women who have young children in particular, there's more flexibility, there's more opportunities available. And so that's part of the increase in the participation in the labor market. Now that we've seen that we can have remote jobs or hybrid jobs or employers being more flexible, that has really helped mothers in terms of being able to hold down jobs. You know, the society has changed a lot since 1950. The post-World War II period was a period of substantial economic growth, and there were rising incomes across the country and across the segments of society. And our income distribution, which is a measure of how income is distributed over households and individuals in a society, was more equal then than it is now. And we had a much more robust middle class than we do now. And so if you look at wages, wages have not kept up with those numbers that I gave you in terms of the increase in housing costs. So in today's society, we do have a more skewed distribution of income where we have a higher percentage at the top and the bottom than we did when compared with 1950. And our middle class is not there like it was in the 1950s. And so this has put pressure on families to move more toward dual income families. Health and education costs are much higher now than they were then. Families carry a lot more consumer debt today than they did in the 1950s. Our savings are lower, our debts are higher. We carry more credit card debt, more debt from medical costs. We carry more education loan debt. So that has all put more pressure on families to move toward a dual income structure.
So it sounds like it really does today take two incomes to support a family.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the changes in life expectancy, now that we're living longer and we want to plan for retirement, I mean, that sort of thing is really a burden for a single income household, because they're trying to pay all these costs of higher prices on things today, and they can't look at that taking care of themselves in retirement as much as they would be able to if there was a dual income family. So it does give them more resources for that sort of planning as well.
Tell me about the financial pros and cons of mothers choosing or not choosing to participate in the workforce.
Well, participating in the workforce, a lot of the pros are, I would say, monetary, because you do have increased household income. You have maybe more financial independence. You, as I mentioned earlier, you can save for retirement. You have Social Security benefits because there are work requirements to be able to obtain Social Security benefits. You also are developing skills, maybe having some career advancement opportunities if you're participating in the workforce. You don't have to worry about reentry if you continue working and you don't take a break when you have children. Many women feel better and more productive when they're working. So there's that well-being sense. So I would say a lot of the pros are monetary and perhaps about well-being. The cons, I would say, are also monetary, because you have childcare costs, you have work-related expenses. You might have to drive to work. You might have to pack a lunch or buy food outside the house. You might have to make some wardrobe changes. There are work-related expenses that can add up. You also have to pay taxes. It can put you into a different tax bracket if you all of a sudden are adding another income earner to your household. And then in terms of non-monetary costs, a big one I would say is stress, because you have to be a really good time manager in order to manage your own work schedule and what's happening in the household. There's less flexibility when you're working. And mothers carry an increased mental load, because even after you get everybody where they need to go for the day, you're still thinking in your mind, who has to be where after school? Who do I need to send an email to their teacher to ask a question? Who needs a dentist appointment? There are all these things that mothers carry in our minds that we have to take care of that really have nothing to do with production on the job. But it's kind of always there, at least in my own experience.
Yes, and mine too.
And so fathers, you know, they can help drive kids here and there. There are a lot of things that fathers can do to share the parenting load. But that mental load seems like it rests much more heavily on the mother than the father. And so that, I think, is a big con in terms of participating in the workforce. You have opportunity costs, giving up time invested maybe in family activities or child development or your own development through further education or hobbies. So, you know, you just have less time when you choose to participate in the workforce.
I know what you mean about the mental load, and as an organizational psychologist myself, thinking about efficiency and effectiveness of employees, looking at a dual career couple, there's an efficiency to having one person carry the mental load. If two people tried to carry it, there's an increased communication, increased decision-making, participative decision-making between two people, and you might lose efficiency if you try to split that mental load, but
true.
Yet one person carrying the mental load is a lot.
Yeah. And it really can affect, you know, your health, because it's very stressful. And so I think that that is an implicit cost of deciding, am I going to go back to work? Am I going to continue to work? That I think a lot of people might not explicitly consider when they're making the decision. A lot of people live with it.
So I'm going to jump back to childcare. You mentioned childcare. If both parents are working, that is a major expense that that family is going to have. 50% of working mothers rely on outside childcare. About 63% are paying for 30 hours or more of childcare per week. And 67% of working mothers say they're spending at least $1,000 a month on child care. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, child care needs significantly affect the woman's employment in a lot of different ways. There's the availability of child care. There's the cost of child care. There's the quality of child care. All of those things have to be considered very carefully for a woman when she's making the decision whether to enter the workforce, remain in the workforce, exit the workforce. And there is a motherhood penalty in the job market. If you take a career interruption, let's say, due to child care responsibilities, research shows that there is this motherhood penalty in earnings. Women tend to earn less. They tend to have slower or no career progression. It's tough if you are completely out of the workforce and you want to come back and you don't have anything, any skills that you've kept up or that you've improved along the way. And, you know, I myself took a career interruption when I had young kids. But I had, you know, as a professor, I had been a professor and then I took a break. I had kids. And during the 12 years that I wasn't full-time, I was still doing some research projects, obtaining grants. I was an adjunct teaching at least one class every semester. And so when I came back full-time, I had a resume that had things on it. And so that was a huge benefit in terms of re-entering the job market. And a lot of women don't have anything. They just have an empty space because they were a CEO in their own household, and that doesn't show up on the resume. So that is a significant penalty for mothers. But I also, and when we talk about childcare, one of the things that I think is a big detriment to families in the U.S. is that we are actually an outlier in a bad way in terms of helping families with childcare as compared to other developed countries. There are articles all the time about different countries, Estonia, Germany, Denmark, those are three that come to mind that have much more generous child care policies. And there are some areas in Germany, for example, where you can get free child care for your child until age 7. And so these are countries that really believe in the value of supporting families and supporting children in particular. And they really are an asset to our society. And I think that it is a terrible thing that the United States does not value child care, does not value the lives of young children and the well-being of families and mothers by investing more in helping families with child care needs and, you know, to continue working and to continue having some sense of well-being as you're having kids and raising the family.
What do you think it'll take to change that?
I think that we're moving into politics at that point because I really think that we're going to need people who really will fight for it. I think that it will require the political process. It has to rise to the top in terms of being valued and being willing to put taxpayer dollars to it, because these countries that I've mentioned have much higher tax rates than we do, and they're using the taxes collected to have a happier population. If you look at studies of happiness, a lot of those countries that have much higher tax rates have a much higher sense of happiness. And so I think that it really is going to take a change in politics, and it's going to take people really fighting for those services and being willing to pay higher taxes. Americans are not willing to pay higher taxes, even when we can make the argument that, you know, we're going to be better off as a nation. We're very much self-centered in terms of what we want to spend our money on.
Well, from one working mother to another, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed this.
So again, this was Dr. Cynthia Harder, professor of economics in the College of Business at Eastern Kentucky University and director of the Center for Economic Education.
Thank you so much.
Making a household's ends meet has become pretty tough for a lot of people. Why? I began looking into it by running a question about our heavy dependence on Chinese imports by Peter Goodman. He's a longtime business reporter at the New York Times. I wonder if people realize how heavily American manufacturers rely on China as a source for many of the parts and the ingredients used in their manufacturing processes. Can you talk to us about that and maybe give us some examples?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, where you are in Eastern Kentucky, you're surrounded by all sorts of factories in many industries, including the auto industry. I mean, the auto industry is a classic example of an industry that is so globalized that you have parts that might be made at a factory in China that are shipped to the United States to be processed in some fashion, then shipped over the border to Mexico to another parts factory that will attach pieces to other pieces to produce yet another part of a part. I mean, this could happen like 40 or 50 times where components are moved around until eventually they turn into a finished product, an auto part that might then be assembled into a finished car in the U.S. or in Mexico. The same holds for other industries, pharmaceuticals, construction supplies, all kinds of industrial machinery. So when you clog up the works, when it becomes difficult for products to move around the globe, we're suddenly reminded that we've built, not by design, but almost by a happenstance combined with a kind of cultish reverence for deregulation, we built this kind of rickety, intricate global supply chain that's really quite fragile. And for most of the time, we don't give much of a thought to it, and we don't have to. It just kind of works. But when there's a shock, we discover that we're dependent upon, you know, lots of human beings who are working in tough jobs that have been downgraded from warehouses to trucking to rail maintenance. Dock workers at the ports have to be able to load and unload containers. And we're dependent on factories that are often on the other side of oceans, bridged by the container shipping industry, which has typically been quite cheap and quite reliable, but it's really a largely unregulated cartel. And anytime there's a shock, prices go up dramatically, and suddenly it's hard for us to get things we take for granted.
The New York Times, Peter Goodman. The post-pandemic economy has cooled a bit, so why do grocery and other consumer prices remain so persistently high? Well, I'm not an economist, but probably, like you, I want to understand this, so I've asked for help from one who definitely knows his way around supply chain dynamics, numbers, stats, and economic trends. Dr. James Kirby Easterling was general manager and entity director of Corning's Supply Chain Management Services Hub in Singapore, but then he transitioned into academia in 2014, where he led the establishment of the Global Supply Chain Management Program at Eastern Kentucky University, the first comprehensive supply chain program in the state. Dr. Easterling, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
And according to the Department of Agriculture, food prices rose by almost 25% between 2019 and 2023, a time frame that, of course, included the pandemic and all that. And there's this report from Purdue University that finds a majority of consumers expect food prices to keep on rising this year. Are food prices as bad as we think they are?
I think there's some information out there that suggests the numbers that you just quoted actually might be understated. Based on my own research, based on research of others that I'm following, there's a number of analysts out there that share that the actual inflation rate for food prices is actually closer to 40%, higher than the 25% that you mentioned.
Well, you know, there's something really interesting in that Purdue report. It's an apparent disconnect, perceived inflation, compared to the official consumer price index. And so, as this report goes, for the last 8 months, consumers have been reporting price inflation that they figure to be in the 6-7% range. So it's well above what food price inflation has actually been if we're going by the consumer price index. But Is this really a perception thing, which kind of suggests that it's all in our minds? I've certainly noticed the jump in my grocery bill for the same exact basket of goods, and given what you just told us, it seems that there might be more going on.
Well, one of the things that I know is going on is that, you know, when we look at things like the Consumer Price Index, CPI, as many listeners may have heard in the past, we have to understand what is included versus what is excluded in that index. You know, the very definition of an index is, You know, it's supposed to be, you know, representative of a wide variety of things. But I've read recently that, you know, some particular items are excluded from that CPI index, which would align with what we are seeing when we go to the grocery stores with, you know, our the price of the same basket of goods, as you mentioned, that we buy compared to what it was, you know, just a few years ago, is definitely higher than what the media is reporting.
I know that you are right now, you're researching this. Supply chains were majorly disrupted during the pandemic. What would be your gauge on the severity of that disruption?
Well, you know, if we think back to COVID, in some ways it seems like it was just the other day, and, you know, in other ways, you know, it obviously seems like it was much longer ago. But, you know, here we are in 2024, and 2020, if we think about it, is not that long ago. And we're talking about, you know, perhaps the greatest disruption in world history, right? This wasn't a local phenomena, right? It wasn't a Richmond phenomena. It wasn't a Kentucky phenomena. It wasn't a United States phenomena. We're talking about a worldwide phenomena that literally affected every commodity, every industry, every profession around the world. And since then, right, if that wasn't bad enough, you have to think about all the things that have happened since then. You know, the war between, you know, Russia and Ukraine that, you know, continues to go on, you know, 2+ years now. We can think about just recently the container ship in Baltimore Harbor that collided with the bridge that, you know, stranded dozens and dozens of container ships loaded with, you know, as I always say, everything from toilet paper to teddy bears. We can think about the conflict in the Middle East with the Suez Canal, you know, one of the major thoroughfares, I guess you might say, for moving product from the southern part of Europe through Africa and the Middle East and on into the Atlantic Ocean. So it's not that, you know, there's been just one thing that's happened. It's all of these things are continuing to happen.
We're all familiar with the concept of supply and demand. How did this huge disruption in the flow of supply of products impact demand-driven consumer-level pricing?
When we think about supply and demand, we have demand that is unchanged, and we have a reduction in supply. Basic economics shares with us that we can expect increases in price. Just like when we think about for the Super Bowl, right? There's a limited number of seats available, right? And there's far more people that want to go to the Super Bowl than the number of seats that are available. And therefore, that's why we see, you know, on the news, Super Bowl tickets are going for, you know, thousands of dollars. Well, when we think about, you know, a global economy, we think about, you know, for example, here in the United States, and this is true for countries all over the world, we receive finished goods from countries all over the world, but we also receive raw materials from countries all over the world. Raw materials means those ingredients, if you will, that we receive from other companies and other countries that we use as part of our manufacturing process. And I'll give you a great example. The container ship that collided with the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore back in March, that particular container port, the Port of Baltimore, receives the majority of raw materials that are used for the making of fertilizer, drywall, and plaster, things of that nature that are used in the construction industry here in the United States. So when we think about, you know, a global economy, it's all interconnected. And when we have a ripple of any size, you know, any kind of a disruption, it's going to have a sort of a magnifying effect as it gets closer and closer to the customer.
Well, are those inflationary dynamics that emanate from disruptions in the supply chain, are those dynamics lingering even as the supply chain seems to be stabilized at this point? Am I right about that?
You know, you are right. And it's a very interesting aspect. And this leads perfectly into some research that I'm working on right now. You know, we can think about, you know, the Federal Reserve and all the things that they've been doing with trying to curb inflation over the last several months, primarily by increasing the interest rate. So the logic is that, you know, if interest rates, the cost of borrowing money goes up, then consumers will be less likely to borrow that money to buy things, right? So that's the logic. But I'm not sure we're actually saying that. Some of the preliminary research that I'm doing right now, if you look at the stock market right now, the stock market is actually at an all-time high. People may not realize that. And to me, it sort of defies logic. You know, we think about, you know, all of these disruptions that are going on across the world, all of these wars and conflicts. We continue to hear about companies that are continuing to struggle for labor. You know, it sort of defies logic that the stock market would be at an all-time high. So I'm not so sure that these interest rate adjustments are having much of an effect on consumers continuing to shop. Because, you know, when I go out, you know, whether it's to Lowe's or Menards or Walmart or Myers or any of these places, they're full of customers. I've never seen more Amazon trucks on the road than I have, you know, in just the last few months. So it's interesting that, you know, the stock market would be doing so well and a lot of companies recording historic profit margins, you know, at a time that there is so much uncertainty around the world.
All right, that's Dr. James Kirby Easterling, a professor in the EKU College of Business, where he focuses on supply chain issues and dynamics, researches them, and as you heard, he has research underway now, and we plan to revisit that when those findings are available. Dr. Easterling also is the author of Supply Chain Simplified. It's a best-selling book used by thousands of college students all across the country. Dr. Easterling, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Coming up after the break, about those personality tests in your career.
There hasn't been a ton of scientific testing on their validity, and the work that has been done shows that they're not actually great at predicting career success.
And Katerina Stoikova's poetic bridge from Bulgaria to Kentucky.
I was hoping to say everything that I need to say about immigration and relationships.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Monday, July 22nd, the Marion County Public Library in Lebanon will host Speakers Bureau, My Dirty Life, presented by Doris Settles. The talk will begin at 5:30 p.m. Also on Monday, July 22nd, the Powell County Public Library in Stanton will host Primetime Family Reading. The program will begin at 5:30 p.m. And on Wednesday, June 24th, the Kenton County Public Library Erlanger Branch will host Speakers Bureau, Exploring Kentucky, Historical Destinations and Natural Wonders, presented by Blair Thomas Hess. The program will begin at 6:30 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. For Kentucky Humanities, I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Ever take one of those personality tests like Myers-Briggs or one of the other ones that have become something of a mainstay? American employers test as many as 60, maybe 70% of applicants' personalities, and increasingly HR personnel are using at least one type of personality test for hiring. But how effective are they in determining, spelling out just who we are, what makes us tick, and whether our personality is going to be a good fit for an organization? Shannon Sauer-Zavala, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Kentucky, has done a lot of work in this area and is here with us to talk about these tests. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Sauer-Zavala.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
And so let's first set the stage for our listeners in this conversation. What are personality tests and what do they measure?
I'll start with what personality is. And so according to psychologists, your personality is your characteristic way of thinking, feeling, and behaving. So like, do you have certain patterns of thoughts or perspectives about the world? Do you tend to feel certain ways about the world? And do you tend to have patterns in your behavior? And so a personality test really just reflects information that you know about yourself back to you. It'll ask you questions, you know, are you the type of person that enjoys being in crowds? Are you the type of person that gets upset easily over minor slights? And you respond to the test by kind of summarizing how you think, feel, and behave typically.
So what are some of the more recognizable personality tests being used today?
You mentioned the Myers-Briggs. The Myers-Briggs is one of the most popular and well-known kind of commercially available personality tests. A lot of employers and schools will use the Myers-Briggs to make suggestions around what would be an ideal profession or role for an employee. Another one that I've seen more frequently sort of on social media is the Enneagram. It's been around for a while, but I think people have started to take that test and, you know, it's sort of risen in popularity. So those are some of the more popular ones.
Are personality tests that people take at work actually backed by science?
Not really. One of the things that I think is so interesting is that personality science, personality research is pretty separate from commercial personality testing. I think there's something really attractive about the outputs that you get from some of these more popular online tests that you can take. It's really cool to be given sort of a profile. Like for me, if I take the Myers-Briggs, my personality type is protagonist. And that's cool. Like that feels nice to kind of get that summary. Whereas I think the more sort of research-based tools for understanding personality kind of need more of a PR makeover because they are just kind of measuring your levels on particular traits. And it doesn't come with that sort of nice, like, you are this type of person. But, you know, unfortunately, these tests that are, you know, like I said, commercially available and popular and kind of come up with this sort of pithy summary of who you are, there hasn't been a ton of scientific testing on their validity. And the work that has been done shows that they're not actually great at predicting career success.
Can a personality be so easily pigeonholed? I mean, aren't we kind of variable?
Yeah, so that's a great thought. I think one of the reasons that personality tests are not great at predicting future success is because personality changes. So who you are in this moment or how you think or feel and behave in this moment, that can evolve based on life experiences. And so because personality changes, it's hard to know how you're going to perform later on in life.
Well, let's say an employer wants to develop a team around a certain product or a project. Can these tests help with that?
I think that they could. I don't know. I'm a little corporation skeptical, I guess I'll say. And so as a personality scientist and as a clinical psychologist, like a therapist, right, that's working one-on-one with like my clients, and my clients are not corporations, they're people. I'm usually pushing people to think about like, and maybe this is cynical, but like, why is your corporation giving you a personality test? Is it because they want you to self-actualize or because they want to make more money and be more productive? So like, I think from like an HR or a corporation's perspective, sure, I think you could see where people are right at this moment and figure out what roles to put them in that they might be more efficient or thrive at right now. I think the problem with that is a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy for people, right? Because what we find is that personality is malleable. As people age, they tend to experience fewer negative emotions, more positive ones. They tend to be more conscientious. They tend to put more value in relationships. They tend to be less judgmental. And we also know that you can speed up that process of personality change by taking intentional actions. And so I think that when somebody gets a personality test result and they're told, well, you're an introvert, you wouldn't be good for leadership, they might take that to heart. They might not put themselves into situations that would push them a little bit to try being maybe a little bit more extroverted, try being a little bit more, you know, in charge of people and see how that goes. And so they maybe don't have the opportunities to evolve because they're kind of putting themselves into a personality type box.
What are some things that an employer or an HR supervisor would want to avoid? If they're going to use a personality test for hiring, what do they want to avoid?
I think that they should avoid telling people this is your type. There's no room for growth here. You wouldn't be good in this particular role, so we're going to put you over here. I think the way that I like to communicate around your current personality and who you could be is that personality changes and you can make volitional choices around nudging traits in particular direction, or you could decide not to. And so one example I always give is like introversion versus extroversion, right? Like, so if you're introverted and you get fulfillment from solitary problem solving at work or interacting with a very small team of like-minded individuals, then they're probably like getting that personality test results and, you know, being like, yep, that checks out for me. That's me. And that really fulfills me. And that's fine. There's no reason to push yourself to make changes. But if you're the type of person that maybe gets the same personality test result, like you're introverted, but you do want to kind of move up, you want to be, maybe your values tell you that you want to be doing kind of the greatest good. And that might mean interacting more with other people. It might mean moving into a leadership role. And so I would hate for the personality test outcomes to be limiting for people and give the impression that this is who you are and this is all you can ever be, because that's really not supported by the science.
Can a test help an employer tailor an employee's work environment to help them be content and as productive as possible?
I think they could. I think it's tough for an employer to decide what is best, I guess, for an individual, because for some people, maintaining the status quo is going to be what's most comfortable for them. And having that knowledge about yourself could help inform what you might ask for in terms of roles or growth at work. On the other hand, I don't know that, I mean, this is my opinion, right? And I'm clearly not an HR person or like a business owner, but like, I don't think it's really up to the corporation to decide if a person should lean into their traits as they are, or if they want to try to develop different traits because their goals are different or their values take them a different way. I think that's a really individual decision around how to use the personality test results.
Well, what are some consequences of using an unreliable personality test?
I think the main consequence is that people are basing really big decisions about who they are, what they can do, who they can be on tests that don't have great science backing them, right? Like, I mean, I've had clients that I've worked with that have said, you know, I'm an ENFJ, so I can only date ENFPs. You know what I mean? Like, that's a really big decision that you're basing, you know, on a personality test that doesn't have a ton of scientific backing, right? I mean, I think it's the same thing with like, you know, people that are really into their zodiac sign, right? Like, we live in a really uncertain time, and I think it's really natural for people to want to understand how they interact with the world around them. And so we gravitate towards these tools that might give us a little bit more information, you know, whether it's like I'm a Libra or I'm an intuitive feeler. I think people can take that information really seriously. Most, you know, Americans are not data scientists. They don't necessarily know how to evaluate the psychometric properties of these personality tests that are on the internet. And there's so much, I think, like colloquial lore around, oh, personality, that's your essence. It couldn't possibly be changed. And I think that that can become really limiting for people.
Well, as a clinical psychologist, what do you recommend employers or supervisors use to get to know employee strengths, weaknesses, tolerances, quirks, and so forth?
I don't think that using personality tests is necessarily a problem. I think that the messaging around the personality testing should be, this is great data for how you are now. But research shows that personality can change. And so as a corporation, we are interested in matching people or helping people achieve their work-related goals. And you can use this information about yourself as a starting point to decide, this is who I am right now. This is actually working for me. I don't really want to make a ton of changes. So I want to kind of lean into where I am right now and what might be roles in the corporation that would suit me. Right. And that's kind of like how these tests are being used now. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that if the person is sort of consenting to it. On the other hand, right, there might be people that are like, well, you know, this is telling me that I'm introverted, or it's telling me that I'm disorganized, right? But like, I don't aspire to be middle management or whatever. Maybe I do have different goals, and knowing where I'm starting can help me think about like the changes I want to make very strategically. And so I think having a really open conversation with the employee around, how do you want to use this information?
Very interesting. Shannon Sauer-Zavala, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Of course, my pleasure. This is one of my favorite things to talk about.
All right. Well, thanks much.
Thank you. 'Cause you've got personality. Walk with personality.
Talk with personality. Smile with personality. Charm with personality. Tom Eblin's latest guest in his series on Kentucky writers has quite a life story, and the way she expresses those experiences brings her to Eastern Standard.
Katerina Stoykova immigrated to the United States from Bulgaria after the Iron Curtain fell in the early 1990s, and she worked hard to achieve the American dream. She earned a bachelor's degree in computer science and an MBA. She worked as a software engineer for IBM and then a project manager for Lexmark. But in 2007, she realized what she really wanted to be was a poet, and in 2010, a publisher of poetry books. Since then, Katerina has published several books of poetry in both English and Bulgaria. Her Accents publishing company has become a major source of high-quality poetry and literary books by Kentucky authors. And she is a big reason Kentucky's poetry scene has flourished over the past dozen years. A new collection of her poetry, Between a Birdcage and a Birdhouse, was recently published by the University Press of Kentucky. It is a very personal book about her experience as an immigrant and an artist, navigating major life transitions and finding her own voice. Katerina Stoykova is with us today to talk about Between a Birdcage and a Birdhouse. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for this kind invitation. It's an honor.
Well, tell us a little about this book and how you put it together.
Well, Between a Birdcage and a Birdhouse is, as you said, my latest book of poetry. And it contains poems that I have written over the last, I would say, 15 years or so. In 2015, I wrote something that I call a love letter to America, and it had to do with what it means to me to be an American, what it means to me to live here, and the complicated relationship I have with this country, which I love dearly. And it was a poem in many pieces, so to say. And I tried to keep this poem as one long poem, and it just somehow didn't work. However, I decided to split it into sections and associate with each section several poems that I have written in the past, and it makes sense that they are kind of like a commentary on my conversation with my adoptive country.
Reading the book, I get the feeling that there's a lot of personal catharsis going on here. What were you hoping to achieve with the book?
I was hoping to say everything that I need to say about immigration and relationships. Immigration is a relationship, and it affects every aspect of one's life and one's thinking. I often say that the best thing that I ever did was immigrate, because it helped me have a whole second brain. Because once you move so far away without anybody else, once you're dropped into a new world, then you start questioning and making new decisions about absolutely every aspect of your life, including, are you going to drive? Are you going to learn how to drive? What are you going to eat? And do you like it or not? Because that's also, in a way, a choice.
Mm-hmm. What's one observation about America that you think a lot of native-born Americans would find surprising?
We work a whole lot more here.
Mm.
Well, I don't know if that's a surprise. It was a surprise for me. And what I have noticed for myself is that I have a different personality for both countries. And as soon as the wheel of the airplane touched down Lexington, Kentucky, I start working.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. A lot of people think we work too much. But what is it about poetry that you love so much?
What I like about poetry is that it can contain strong emotions. And that's why people cannot read poetry like 8 hours a day, because it has so much. The feeling explodes into the reader, and that's why you can read, you know, fiction for 8 hours. So that's what I like, that it can contain a secret to a point, but it can also contain an emotion.
Mm-hmm. And I find that I have to read a book of poetry several times, really, to kind of fully appreciate it, because you read sections of it and let that settle, and then you come back.
That's interesting. I read a poetry book for first time for emotion, and every subsequent time I read it to learn about the craft, because many of the really good poetry books, there is so much to learn.
Right, yeah, that's true. That's true. What do you hope that people will learn from your poetry?
I hope that people learn about the immigrant experience, what it feels like to live two places at the same time, even though you don't inhabit both of them simultaneously. And people can understand about the need of going back and forth, and that it's not a luxury.
Mm-hmm.
Going back home, wherever home happens to be, because at some point you don't really know.
I mean, you know, it's one thing to learn another language, but then to be able to write poetry well in another language. And English and Bulgarian are very different languages. How did you manage to do that so well?
I started writing poems when I was 8 years old. And I think that just having my brain wired for poetry at such an early age, that helps me think and see metaphors. And then when I immigrated in the United States, when I was 24, I didn't write for 11 years. And then I started writing in English, not very well, but I started writing in English. And I understood that for an entire year, I'll have to write and throw away everything that I've written, so that I can learn to write in another language and to come up to speed and to the level of skill that I had 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a hard decision. And with some chagrin, I decided, okay, fine, I'll do it. And I did it. And I'm glad, because it was an obstacle that kind of tested me. And then I went to school. I decided that if I really am serious about writing, I need to get more education. And I need to read as much as I can. And I also need a guide, or guides better. So I went to the Spalding MFA, and I got an MFA, and I got some of the best mentors in the country. And by the time I graduated with my MFA degree, I had already the Accents podcast, and Accents Publishing Press had 2 books announced.
Well, can you read something from your new book?
Yeah, I'll read to you Black Stone Over White Stone after Cesar Vallejo. And there is the mention of Burgas, which is my hometown. And this poem is written after the famous poem by Cesar Vallejo, Black Stone Over White Stone. His is a sonnet. Mine isn't.
Hmm.
I will die in Burgas under the pouring rain that falls once a year or two whenever I can visit. I will die on the 8th floor balcony at sunrise as the sky tugs the sun's soul out of the Black Sea shimmer. It will be a Friday, as it is today, because as I write these lines, I notice how the work week ends and how I crawl into another pile unfinished business. Katerina died during her visit. Whoever is returning to Kentucky, isn't she, believe me, determined to remain unnoticed, this person mirrors her disappearing foreign bones completely. The only witnesses remain the balcony, the rain, the constant resurrections.
Oh, that's very nice. Well, in addition to being a poet, you're a teacher and a publisher who really nurtures poets. Why has this work become so important to you?
I have received so much from my literary community in Bulgaria. They practically adopted me and raised me since my teenage years. And quite frankly, they are one of the big reasons that I survived my teenage years. And we were meeting every Thursday at 7 p.m. in a writer's group that was free and open to everybody. And then fast forward about a decade later, when Colin Watkins and I started Poesia, this free and open group for everyone, and they still meet.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to start meeting in Common Grounds at 7 p.m. And that really grew many poets, and it was instrumental for me to continue writing and to one of the reasons to develop into a poet who is bilingual and is published at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, my guest has been Katerina Stoykova, author of the new poetry collection Between a Birdcage and a Birdhouse, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Katerina, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
For the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, this is Tom Eblin reporting for Eastern Standard.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or maybe suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.